Support for Best of Belfast comes from listeners just like me who love Northern Ireland and believe we have a better story to tell. Massive thanks to all of you listening who have already joined the Producers Club, especially our Titanic producers, Barclays Eagle Labs, Ulster University, Young Enterprise Northern Ireland, Gavin Wall, Peter Dixon, and of course, the Ormobiles team. To find out more about how you can support independent ad-free media, get invitations to live podcasts and submit questions to our guests, please visit bestofbelfast.org. Thanks so much, and we really hope you enjoy today's show.
All right, guys, what's the crack? My name is Matthew Thompson, and welcome to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. And we're definitely sitting down with an incredible woman today. And this is our special 90th episode. And really, really excited. So we have Baroness May Blood in with us today. It says here that May Blood grew up in a working class area of Belfast. At 14 years old, she began working in the local mill and before long got heavily involved in advocating for women's rights. Although you would probably say there's no such thing as women's rights.
Correct.
And after being brought up in a mixed community, she watched in disbelief as that community disintegrated during the Troubles. At this time, May became increasingly involved in grassroots community work and a key player in the peace process. Mm-hmm. So in 1999, in recognition of her years of trade union and community endeavours, May Blood was offered a life peerage and sat in the House of Lords. Something that was a surprise to you, wasn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
Now, since 2002, Baroness May Blood has been the campaign chair of the Integrated Education Fund in Northern Ireland and has helped raise over $18 million to support their mission.
Absolutely.
In today's episode, we talk all about what it was like growing up in Belfast in the 40s, her time in the House of Lords, and why integrated education is essential to overcoming the pain of our past. All this and more coming up on today's exciting 90th episode special.
Hi, I'm May Blood, and you're listening to Best of Belfast.
All right, folks, what's the crack? My name's Matthew Thompson, and welcome to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. The show is brought to you from our recording studio in Ormo Baths, Barclay Eagle Labs, a co-working space right here in the heart of the city centre. Support for Best of Belfast comes from listeners just like you, who pledge as little as £1 a month to join the Producers Club, get invitations to live podcasts, and support us on our journey to 100 interviews. Big, big thanks to all of you who make the show possible, especially our Titanic producers, Barclays Eagle Labs, Ulster University, Gavin Wall, and of course, the wonderful Ormo Baths team. To find out more, get in touch, or check out our back catalogue of over 80 incredible interviews, please visit bestofbelfast.org. That's it from me for now. It's time to jump straight into our conversation with this week's local legend. Really hope that you enjoy. Slandered the other day by a woman called Zoe Salmon. She works in TV.
Oh, I know Zoe.
Yeah, so she was here last week and she was saying, you really need to get better sound check questions, because I usually ask people, you know, what did you have for breakfast or something like that. And so Manumi, what I'm trying out is, do you have a first memory as a child? Much more deeper than the breakfast question.
Yes, I do.
What is
my
it?
First memory of the child was the Blitz.
Really? That's your first memory?
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was, my middle family, my two brothers and sisters, were evacuated. There was only a sister and I left at home. And I remember we had to go into the coal house, which was underneath the stairs when there was an air raid. And we live quite close to the Blackie River. And the place crawled with cockroaches.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's my earliest
memory. That's
your
first memory?
That's my first memory.
Wild.
I don't remember my brothers and sisters. Apparently, I visited them in the country, but I don't remember it.
Wow.
Don't remember it at all.
And as I was saying to you in the coffee shop there, so I live on Thelia Street on the Donegal Road. And so were you Roden Street or near Roden Street?
Yes, I lived in off Roden Street.
Right, so I walk past Roden Street almost every day.
I lived in Magnetic Street, which isn't there now.
Oh, it's gone.
It's gone. But we used to go down, you know where the West Link is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, we lived just beyond the West Link.
Right, so this was my question, because I only discovered this recently. I was cycling. I was out cycling And I've always known Roden Street to be on Donegal Road.
Yes.
But then I was over near the hospital and there was another Roden Street. And for the first Grosvenor time Road. Ever in my life, I realised...
I lived on the Grosvenor Road end of it.
So did the motorway cut it in half?
Yes.
Right.
It used to be a river. It used to be called... It was a Black Staff River. I thought it was a Black Mountain... I thought it was Black... Black Mountain River, but it was Black Staff River.
Wow.
And actually what happened was when during the Troubles and we had to move out and all... The houses were taken down, and that's where they built the West Link and the motorway.
Over the river?
Over the river,
oh,
yes. That's
word.
Why it floods.
Of course
there's
it
two,
is.
There's two rivers there meets, and that's why it floods so badly.
Wow. So what was your kind of first house like as a child?
Oh, our first house was what we called two up and two down.
That's what I'm in, yeah.
Yeah, we had, and you understand that. And there was nine of us.
Oh, my goodness. There's so, two of us, me and my wife.
It was quite a squeeze. There was nine of us, so there was... But it was remarkable in those days because you never actually thought about it. Mm. Everybody lived the same. Mm. And, you know, I'm on record as saying at the time we were poor, but we didn't know we were poor.
Sure.
Because we had no social workers to tell us. But everybody had the same. So you didn't think you were any poorer than anybody else. Mm-hmm. The only difference in our, I lived where there was three streets. The only difference in our three streets was if somebody's father was out of work, all the families that had somebody working would have made a meal for that family.
Oh, really?
And I remember my mother making soup. And I went down and asked Mrs. So-and-so, can she take a pot of soup? I went down, yes. That pot went up and down, up and down for months. Which only when I grew up, I realised that was my mother's way of making a Sunday meal for that family.
Wow.
Because their father didn't work. It never even crossed my mind as a child.
Yeah, yeah.
It's only when I grew up and began to understand things.
Wow.
But that's the way life was. If it was a death, everybody piled in. Mm. If it was a birth, everybody piled in. And even the time we were badly flooded, one time to a depth of 5 feet, somebody didn't close the culvert gates where the West Link is now, and the water all came back. And it was right up the our fireboard in the house. And even then, the people all just came together and helped one another.
Crazy.
And it was crazy stuff.
Yeah. You mean you were born in a very interesting moment in history? I mean, you said your first memory was the Blitz.
Yeah.
And, you know, what an interesting and difficult period of history you've lived through as
well. Yeah,
I mean, I got to admit, like, so, you know, we live there now. And that sense of community you're talking about, I'm going to be honest, I've never experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
When I was being reared, community was everything because we had nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I lived in a little part of the world that was mixed.
Yeah.
Our next door neighbours were Catholic, across the street were Catholic. That didn't matter.
Yeah.
We were all together. Whatever needed to be happened. And there was all that neighbourliness. I was just saying to someone the other day, all those years I don't remember us locking our front door. It wouldn't have been done. It just wouldn't have been done.
Yeah.
But when the Troubles broke out, that changed all that. And that idea of neighbourliness and community, you either went into your own community, the Catholic or the Protestant community, mm-hmm. you formed the alliances there, but there was never the coming together again.
So how did that work on like a street level for you, if you were all, you know, living together?
It worked on a street level that nobody recognised anybody by their religion,
wow.
their colour or anything. Everybody was the same. We all, well, yes, we went to different schools, we were aware of that. And, you know, I often say... one of my earliest memories at that time was just after the war, the Americans sent big boxes of red apples.
Oh, no
way. For primary school children, and you got two. And I remember going over, we had a Catholic family live facings. I remember going over and getting one of the lads. We went down to my school in Sandy Row and we got two apples each. Then he took me up to St. Paul's in the Falls and we got two more. So I was always destined to be cross community.
So you went to school on Sandy Row then?
Yes, I went to school in Bly Street.
Nice one.
I went to school off of Donegal Road first.
Yeah.
Donegal Road Methodist Church, primary school. We called it Tin Top. Because it had a tin roof and it was great in the winter. You couldn't hear the teacher. It was brilliant when it rained. And then when the 11 plus and all, I was transferred down to Bly Street. Went in for the 11 plus and passed it.
Nice.
Now, I have to say my mother and father had no idea what I was doing. They took no interest in it as far as that was concerned. My dad was working in the shipyard. My mum was out doing all the work she could do. And so therefore it was just another exam.
Mm.
I passed it and I wanted to be a school teacher.
Wow.
Now, I don't know why, because I hated school.
Interesting.
I hated school with a passion.
Where'd that come from then?
I have no idea. Unless I seen the teacher had some power.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's for me.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. But, you know, when I'm out doing prize giving and all now, I would say to class students, you know, I had a great relationship with my headmaster.
Uh-huh.
I seen him every day in the week. because I was always in detention. I was always in trouble. I hated school. Hated it.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a school teacher. My dad put down my first preference as Grosvenor High. Now, for one reason only, Grosvenor High was out our back. It's where Kelvin Primary School, or Intermediate School was. That used to be Grosvenor High School.
Oh, okay.
So my dad reckoned it was only one step out the back door and I'd be in school. I wanted to go to Methody because in those days you went to Methody and into Stranmillers College. Because Grosvenor accepted me, Methody couldn't offer me a place.
Oh, man, is that how it worked?
And I just said, right, that's it, I'm not going anywhere. And I stayed in Sandy Row, the wee school in Sandy Row, left school at the age of 14.
Wow. And I don't know if you have seen this, there's a bridge on the Donegal Road where that new Eurospar is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's got all these wee kind of poems mm-hmm. and things on it. One of them is called Millie, and it's written from the perspective of a wee girl working in the mills.
That's right. That's
and
right.
You worked in the mills,
didn't
you?
Oh, yeah, I was a Millie. I was a Millie for 38 years. In fact, we have a thing just as you turn into one of the streets coming off the Crumlin Road, and there's a statue there to Millie.
Ah.
I opened it, but I was a Millie. And I was really angry at the time because when that came out, Stephen Nolan tried to make out like Millie was a derogatory term for people who run about in their pyjamas. Yeah. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest. So I grew up, a millie was a derogatory term you would use for someone who I suppose was lower class, which, whenever I read that poem, I actually finally connected the dots. I was like, right, this is what this is about. Yeah, this is where this is coming from.
Yes, so we got that name working in the mill. You were a millie. Whatever your job was in the mill, you were a millie. And I was proud to be a millie for 38 years.
38 years?
Yep. I went into the mill for a fortnight. When I left school at the age of 14, I left on a Friday, came home. Mum says, right, out and get a job. No such thing as sitting about. One of my older sisters took me around several places, and the only place I could get a job was in Blackstaff, which was at the top of our street almost. Yeah. It's where the Royal Victoria Hospital is. And this guy offered me a job as a hooker. And I had no idea what the man was talking about. But when I went into the mill, I was only going in for a fortnight. Because my mother worked in Mackey's at the time and she had got me a job in Mackey's office.
Mackey's big machinery, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, big engineering company.
Biggest in the world at one point,
and,
maybe,
wasn't it? Yes, they travelled the world. And the thing was that when you went from being in the mill up to an office position, that was social mobility. Mm. That was a step up as far as my mother was concerned.
Yeah.
And the job wasn't coming up for a fortnight, so you were in the mill for the fortnight, but I stayed 38 years. I loved the mill. I loved it.
I had no idea that you stayed that long.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I stayed 38 years, and you talk to anybody who's ever worked in the mill, they'll all tell you the same thing. It was just great inside the gates. Now, it was hard work, poor wages.
Sure.
Conditions were appalling.
Yeah.
But we were a community within a community.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we worked together like that. And, you know, I just like that. And in actual fact, going into the mill, 5 years later, I became a shop steward.
Nice.
Quite by accident.
Yeah.
My father didn't want me even to join the union. My father thought trade union for men.
Yeah.
And I joined. I reckon he didn't need to know. It was only a shell in the week.
Your work, your business.
Yeah, absolutely. And I joined it. And then I got the chance to become a shop steward for a month.
Wow.
Because the officer couldn't get anybody to take responsibility. And my boss said to me, he laid down a whole lot of rules, what I could and couldn't do.
Uh-huh.
And I remember coming out of his office that day and saying, well, if you're that angry about it, that's for me. And I have to say, I joined the Transport and General Workers Union, and that's where I got my education.
Wow.
That officer seen some potential. I didn't see it, but he seen some potential. And he sent me to every course. I studied the whole law around industry.
Amazing.
And negotiation, all that kind of things that all helped me in later life.
Yeah.
Didn't realise at the time, but that's where I got my education. Wow. Yeah,
I would love to dive into that trade union stuff a wee bit more. But
okay.
Before, I mean, just literally in my ignorance, what did you actually do in the mill? Like, what were you doing?
Right.
Like,
when I was told I was going to be a hooker.
Yeah, so what were you hooking?
Right, what was the Blackstaff produced linen.
Okay.
And there was big, big metal hooks on the wall.
Yeah.
And my job was to hook the linen at certain lengths. And when you had so many hooked, you then lifted it off,
okay.
put it on the table and cut it up into those lengths. We made sheets, pillowcases, all that kind of thing. And you were a hooker. And it was only in later years they modernised me within the electric cutting machines and all that. Mm. But at that time, it was all done by hand.
Yeah.
But I always remember some years ago, John Reid, he was the Secretary of State here at the time. And we were at a dinner up in Hillsborough, and John said to me, could I ask you, maybe, what was your first job? I says, yes, but if I tell you, John, sure you won't tell anybody. And he says, well, what was it? I says, I was a hooker. And he started to laugh. So he did. But that's what it was. You're hooking up blank pieces of linen, certain lengths, and then lifting them off these two big metal pins, turning them around, throwing them on the table and cutting them up.
Wow. So, I mean, how old were you when you left the mill then?
I left the mill at 52.
Wow. That explains so much because, you know, in prepping this interview, you know, I know you shouldn't split life up into kind of chapters, but, you know, it seems to be 14, worked at the mill, and then all of a sudden we jump all the way forward. I mean, talking about the service level stuff, you know, and it's like all of a sudden you're in the House of Lords and it's like, what happened in that gap? Like, so those were those unseen years you were working away.
I went through so many stages. I mean, when I got my education through the trade union, I began to get involved in different things. I sat on industrial tribunals, social service tribunals, got all that kind of information, working hard in the mill. And then when the troubles broke out and we had to move, we were burned out of our home by Protestants. When we had to move, then when I went to this estate, at that time it was just falling apart. So I got involved in community work and peace work, and that just went on and on. I was still working in the mill at this time, but that went on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And that eventually ended up in the House of Lords.
So why do all this extra work outside of your day-to-day mill life? Because I'm sure a lot of people, when we went to the mill and then went home again, was it inside of you that made you
know.
Go after that stuff?
You know, someone asked me, I think it was interviewed over a year ago, and someone asked me the same question. I said, well, the only thing I can boil that down to is I'm nosy. And I just wanted to know what everybody was doing. And that's not strictly true. It's just one thing led to the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, in the middle of the troubles in the late 70s, early 80s, when there were really, really terrible stuff going on, people were looking for somebody to lead.
Sure.
And in my estate, it was always me. It was always me blood. And then gradually you were recognised by government and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And gradually that raised your whole profile. Then I went to America a number of times to speak on community and how we were trying to. I lived beside a 27-foot wall. I still do.
Wow.
But we worked on with the people on the other side of the wall.
Yeah.
Because they had the same problems as us.
Sure.
Exactly the same. So it made sense to join together. And when Protestant Catholic came together like that, we just absolutely threw the whole system into chaos because they didn't know how to deal with us.
Sure, yeah.
When we went up as a Protestant group, we were told we would love to do that for you, but we'd have to do it for the Greens. When they went up, they were said, yeah, that's a good idea, but we'd have to do it for the Orange. When we went together, there was no answer.
Wow.
So that we played on that. Sure. We absolutely played on that. We took advantage of it.
So walk me through, how did all of that, I'm going to call it groundswell movement, that's maybe a bit of a crass way to put it, how did that actually lead to you then, 1999, being offered a place?
Well, over the years, I mean, in the turn of the 90s, when it looked like there'd been a lot of secret peace talks going on, and I was involved in a couple of them over in America and that, and it always fascinated me. We went to America, nobody was to know we were there, but everybody knew we were there. It's typical Northern Ireland. But gradually, as you got involved in one thing, you seemed to get involved in another.
Sure.
And during the 90s, I mean, I had remarkable honours paid to me, and it just fascinated me. Mm. I met the Queen, I got an MBE,
wow.
I got several, I have three honorary doctorates, all that kind of thing. And Mo Molan was the Secretary of State here. And Mo was a great personal friend, apart from anything else. And Mo and I had done a lot of work, as most of the Women's Coalition did, in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mo asked me to go into prisons and visit the Loyalist prisoners, make sure they were staying on board with the peace process. We'd done all that quietly. And you're not told who actually put your name forward for the House of Lords, but I always felt it was Mo Molan.
Yeah.
I always believed that. And then I got a letter. I was actually going to retire because at that time I got the opportunity in 94, 95 to help to set up a Sure Start, an early years programme on the Shankill. And we got money from Europe. We got £6.5 million from Europe. We built three beautiful centres. We were working with 1,000 families. So we were getting more involved in other things.
Yeah.
And then when the peace talks came up and we formed the Women's Coalition, I was the campaign chair. We wanted women to the actual, we wanted them in the front table.
Mm-hmm.
And that was achieved. And then I had decided to retire at 61 because I'd always promised myself when I got to 60 I'd retire. So I said to my boss, Jackie Redpath at the time, I said, Jackie, I'd like to go. He says, well, would you stay to get somebody in your place? I said, yeah. During that time, as I say, Mo was asking me to do little things in the background, go with her to visit different places.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a phone call one morning from one of Mo's private office. I need to come up and see you. I thought it was something else. He came up and I said, what is it you want this time? He says, no, May, there's no easy way to say this. You're being offered a life peerage.
Whoa.
I said, what's that when you're writing home? I hadn't a clue what the man was talking about. Now, I knew it was a place called the House of Lords.
Sure, yeah.
But like most people, I thought it was rich old men who sat and slept all day. And he says, you're being offered a seat in the House of Lords. And I was so ignorant. I says, what'll I do with it? I thought they were going to give me a chair.
Yeah. You know, for a bit around your kitchen table.
Anyway, I said no. Uh-huh. It was just a step too far for an ordinary working girl from Belfast.
Why was it a step too far?
Because it was another world that I wasn't familiar with. Mm-hmm. And I wondered exactly what I could achieve in the House of Lords.
Yeah.
You know, I was so busy at home and I was looking forward to retiring.
Yeah.
And this would have meant a whole change of lifestyle. And I went away anyway, and I have a very strong Christian faith, personal faith, and I prayed about it. I've always believed all my life that God has opened doors for me. And I come to the realisation this was another door.
Mm.
And I phoned Chris back and said, look, I've changed my mind. He says, that's all right. The Prime Minister very kindly granted you 3 days to think about it. And apparently anybody's offered a life period accepts within 5 minutes.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
But I was offered 3 days. But you're not allowed to make it public knowledge that Tony Blair actually writes to you personally and tells he's putting your name up to the Queen. And that happened. And then you're sent for and you set a title. And then you get a date for what they call the ennoblement. And from then on, and when I first went into the House of Lords, I was absolutely bewildered.
I bet.
I didn't know what I was there for. There was no job. Nobody told you what you were to do.
And there's no employee handbook, is there?
No. You went in, all of a sudden, everybody in these black coattails knew I was Lady Blood. And I was saying, I wonder how they all know who I am. But apparently the photo's on the wall and they're taught to study it.
Mm.
And I have to say, from I entered into the House of Lords, everybody was very supportive.
Wow.
Now, I didn't have to know the people, but they all seemed to know me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand how they knew me. But I understand now that most of them had Googled me. But, you know, you settle into the House of Lords, and I mean, I talk about doors in your life. I mean, there's nowhere that I've ever been there's more doors than the House of Lords. And it's trying to find your way through that and what you're actually supposed to be doing there.
Mm.
Now, I have to say the first year I was in the House of Lords was the loneliest year I've ever spent.
Wow.
One, I didn't feel at home in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I was away from home for 3 days a week. And I used to walk Oxford Street. I know all the coffee bars.
Yeah.
And then I made up my mind one night. I said, if you're not going to go and make this work, you may as well go home.
Sure.
And it can be very daunting to open a door and there's 200 people in a room and you don't know one of them.
Mm.
It takes a lot of... And Northern Ireland people aren't like that.
Yeah, that's true.
So anyway, I decided that if I was ever going to move things on, that's what I have to do. And I got involved in the work. And I have to say it was the best thing I ever done.
Wow.
So many more doors were open for me. Integrated education, for instance, which is my passion. And I like to think it was also Mo Mullen's passion. So I like to think I'm carrying on some of the work Mo would have done.
Amazing. Talk to me a wee bit about Mo. How'd you meet Mo?
I met Mo years and years and years through the trade union.
Mo was
a trade unionist, but she was also an MP.
Yeah.
And I remember being at several conferences where Mo Mullen came and joined us.
Yeah.
Mo was always after free cigarettes. She didn't buy them. She looked at everybody else's. And we just formed that friendship.
Yeah.
You know, there was just something about Mo that I liked.
Yeah.
She was irreverent. Yes, she could drink most people onto the table. Sometimes her language was a bit hairy, but Mo at her heart was really a good woman.
Mm.
And that really attracted me. And I worked with her on a number of things. And then when the Labour Party got in and Mo became the Secretary of State, Mo had already done 3 years' work here in Northern Ireland before that. She was here every month with Nigel, our PA, and they would have visited most community groups.
Mm-hmm.
She knew everybody by first name. And I remember at the time someone making an issue out of the fact that she called Martin McGuinness Babe.
Uh-huh.
Mo called everybody Babe. That was a term. It's like us in Northern Ireland, we call everybody Love.
Yeah, or Pet or something like that.
Yeah. She just called everybody Babe. But Mo was, I liked Mo because we have a saying here in Northern Ireland, there's no back doors in Mo.
Yeah.
And if Mo didn't like what you were saying, she told you straight.
Yeah.
And she'd done so many things for me during the peace process and during the talks of Stormont and afterwards. And I met her just before she died, and then she died a tragic death. But Mo, you know, people here don't realise the work Mo Mullen really did for the peace process.
This is why I asked the question. So I was born in 95.
Yeah.
So for lack of a better term, I'm a child of the Good Friday Agreement. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I've grown up and I learn about the Troubles. I'm backdating, you know, I have to go back and look.
Yeah.
And I will be completely honest, and this is, you know, shame on me, but I have only discovered Mo Mullen in recent years.
That's because Mo was airbrushed out.
What do you mean?
She was a woman. She was airbrushed out by Tony Blair.
Mm.
I mean, Mo done all the groundwork.
Yeah.
For the talks.
Because that's what I'm hearing.
She'd done all the groundwork. The thing was, at a big conference during these talks, a big Labour Party conference in England, the people there, the delegates there, gave Mo a 5-minute standing ovation.
Whoa.
And Blair never got over it. You don't upstate your leader, which Mo did. Now, fair play to Mo, she didn't want, but...
Sure.
But she did. And when the whole thing, when started to make progress here with Blair and all that, and Bertie Ahern and people like that, Mo was just sort of brushed out. Mm. And even in the recent 20 years, when we celebrated it,
yeah.
There was no mention of Mo Mullen at all.
Interesting.
And my theory on that is, one, she was a woman.
Yeah.
So she was easy to airbrush out. And two, you take the glory away from these men if you do that. But Mo's legacy is still there.
Oh,
I mean, Mo supported the Women's Coalition. Mo supported a lot of stuff, integrated education. So that work's still there, and her history will go on for a long time.
Yeah, that's it. You mentioned the word loneliness.
Yeah.
And you're probably aware of this, but loneliness is like a real bit of a hot topic at the minute, mm-hmm. because so many people my age are experiencing loneliness. You know, talk before about how that sense of community and even the two up, two downs, even people in clues, it's not really there anymore. But have you ever felt lonely as a leader? You know, I've heard people talk about the loneliness of leadership.
Oh, yes. And you know, people don't realise sometimes there's a moral issue that you have to deal with as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me give you an example. I remember one time on the Shankill, we were approached for protection money for a particular program I was involved in. And I went to see the powers to be, and over a period of time, we got it reduced and we paid the money. But it was very little compared to what they'd asked.
Yeah.
I re-edited that story again. I was speaking one night at an event some years later, and I didn't know there were 5 policemen in the audience. I didn't know. And they got up and walked out.
Interesting.
Because they said that I had actually given money for guns to be bought to shoot them. But that was a moral decision. My decision was here, not just me, the people who were leading this early years programme, the decision was, do we pay £5,000and risk building a £1 million centre, or do we not pay that and we never get the £1 million centre?
This is the issue. Like, so many things in life are not black and white.
No.
Sure,
and
not.
People don't realise that. I mean, a lot of leaders have to struggle with themselves for the better good. I mean, at that time, I lost friends over that.
Sure.
Because they couldn't understand how we come to pay paramilitaries. But I always believed if we got the £1 million centre built on the Shankill, that it would prove its worth. And I mean, 23 years later, we were told it wouldn't work. Mm. We were told that by the elected representatives that it wouldn't work. What would we know? Blah, blah, blah. 23 years later, we're still there. And we work with over 1,000 families. So I reckon, even though it meant going against strict moral codes, I reckon that was a decision well made at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you think of, like, something we're really interested in as a show and kind of as the moral impact we're trying to have with this is celebrating Northern Ireland and sharing a different variety of voices. Something I have noticed is our language around certain parts of Belfast is really interesting. That's really wrong. Mm-hmm. So there are rough parts of the city, or there are bad areas, or there are ghettos, or there are all this sort of stuff. Like, how do you think we can change that? Because even again, so I'm 24, a lot of people my age, you know, they're getting their first jobs, they're starting to think about buying houses, and no one is thinking about, you know, there's certain areas that, oh no, you couldn't live there, you couldn't buy a house there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you think we can do to change that?
But, well, I have to say, I've been really encouraged this last couple of years with the attitude of young people. And, you know, you can see that changing. I can see that changing.
Yeah.
I can see young people coming up at 16, 17, 18, beginning to ask political questions that I wouldn't have dreamt of asking. Now, that's the way you change the system.
Yeah.
You change the system upwards. You don't change it top down. You change it upwards. And I think, you know, there's a big debate on about giving 16-year-olds the vote. Mm. I really believe that should be.
Brilliant.
Because a 16-year-old now is far, far mature than I ever was at 16. Mm-hmm. I was very naive at 16. But young people now, with the education system here, which is good, they come out, and particularly they go to an integrated school, they come out well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
They've studied for years with people from different religions, perhaps different countries, different faiths, and they come out knowing that's the way the world is.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't come out of school saying, well, I'm a Protestant and everybody I'm going to meet is a Protestant. It doesn't work like that. But I think you can see that change slowly coming. I think it mightn't come as fast as I would like it, but you can see that slowly changing. And young people now, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Belfast closed down at 7 o'clock at night.
Sure.
I remember, you know, all those things. But when you take it now, young people just go out and enjoy themselves, and that's the way it should be. And I think that will gradually, it mightn't happen tomorrow, but I think that will change that whole system. But it's up to young people. It's up to the like of you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm too old, I'm gone, you know. But let's say I put the foundations in, but it's up to you to build on it.
Yeah. It's funny, you talk even about young people going out. I was talking to somebody, or I was talking to a taxi driver, and they were talking about how amazing it was how they see that happening in a physical sense. So the taxi driver was saying, you know, he's picking people up in the Shankill and taking them to parties in the Falls.
Absolutely.
And he's picking people up from North Belfast, taking them to South Belfast, and there's just real movement
Absolutely.
Of young people
Absolutely.
Across the city.
And that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
That's the way it should be. I mean, for years, young people just stayed in their own area.
Yeah.
And they were getaways in many ways. They just interned themselves. But that's all changing. Mm. And I mean, young lads on the Shankill and I would go with girls from Ardoyne.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's fascinating. I was saying to someone the other day, I seen a young lad walking down the Shankill with a Holy Cross sweatshirt on. Now, that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. But that's all changing.
Yeah.
And you don't hear the same, certainly among my age you do, but young people now don't talk about religion the way we did.
Sure.
You know, I was talking to an elderly lady yesterday, and she was absolutely appalled that some relation she knew had went to work on the Falls and married one of them.
How dare he?
Now, 96 years of age, and she still has those things.
Crazy.
And I was saying to myself, dear God. You know, but that's the way life was. I'm old enough to remember, Matthew, in our street, there was a family arrived. She was a Protestant from the Shankill. He was a Catholic from the Falls. And they had to move out. They'd have
Seriously?
Been killed in their own areas. So they came to live among us because we were a mixed area.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was so hilarious. On one day, the priest visited them. And the next day, the minister of the church visited them. You know, but, you know, that's the way life was. And now today, I mean, mixed marriage is a growing phenomenon
yeah.
here in Northern Ireland.
Oh, wow.
You know, and you know, it's just one of those things, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
That's the way it should be. I mean, all my life, and I've travelled quite extensively, but you don't sit down beside somebody and say, by the way, are you a Protestant or a Catholic? You know, and I remember some years ago, I was invited to a reception in America. I was over for a conference, and I went up to this reception, and the lady sitting beside me is an American, and she says to me, where are you from? I says, I'm from Protestant West Belfast. You're a Protestant? And I said, yeah. She says, oh, my God, I wish my mother was alive to see this. And I was looking at her. You know, she just thought that was extraordinary.
Wow.
To me, it was. I went to their reception because it was the best food. You know? But times are changing.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Times are changing. I mean, massively changing. Even around the whole idea of abortion and same-sex marriage and all those things. When I was young, they weren't even discussed.
Oh, I wasn't even on the table.
Not at
yeah.
all. You know, I remember my father and I watching television one night. This is years ago. My father's dead in the 70s. And I remember we were watching something from Las Vegas, and my father says, my God, that man needs his eyes tested. I says, why? He says, look at the ugly woman he's married. It was another man. But he never even crossed his mind.
That's
never
hilarious.
Even crossed his mind.
Hilarious.
You know?
I don't know if you have any opinion on this. So something that I'm passionate about, or I suppose something that makes me frustrated, is the way local media talks negatively about Northern Ireland. And I heard someone recently say, it seems like the front page has stayed the same for the last 40 years.
It drives me mental.
Talk to me about that.
It drives me mental. I mean, there's loads and loads of good work going on all over Northern Ireland.
I agree.
But you don't hear about it.
Yeah.
But we've only to hear of a bomb scare or something like that, and it's front news. And I asked several of the media why they'd done this, and they said good news doesn't sell.
Wow.
Now, we don't sell that, so we don't. And, you know, I was last Saturday, I was down visiting some travel agents from Holland, and they're here trying to set up this. We need tourism, we need that work. And, you know, we have got to get away from this idea.
100%.
You know, that there is no good news here. Everything's doom and gloom.
Yeah.
It's a lot of nonsense.
It is.
It is an absolute lot of nonsense. I mean, even on the Shankill, which is sometimes poo-hooed, there's amazing good work going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you ask, you take, for instance, the boys' model.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the boys' model has really turned itself around. Really. Really turned itself around. And when they asked the media to do a programme on it.
Terrible.
Because it was good news.
Yeah.
They didn't want to know. But if that school had been ratting, they'd have been up on the door.
You can be sure.
Now, That will slowly change too. Will slowly change. It has to. Mm-hmm. It has to because, I mean, while from all over the world you hear negative stories, but you also hear good news. Aye. And we've got to get to Northern Ireland where we start producing that more and more for the public.
Yeah, brilliant. What is it about integrated education? Why have you dedicated so much of yourself to it? Out of all the issues you could have tackled in this kind of season of your life, because since 2002 you've been the campaign chair, isn't it? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, out of all the issues in the world that you could have really thrown your weight behind, why integrated education?
Well, let me explain. When I got the title...
How did you become a baroness, by the way?
I became a baroness because Tony Blair put my name forward to the Queen.
Oh, yeah?
And that's how you get the title. You're ennobled, as they call it.
Wow.
And it can't be taken away from you. That's my title there for the rest of my life. But when I got the title first, I'd heard about integrated education, but I wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. To me, it was middle class. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something my community could be proud of. And that's what I thought.
Yeah.
2001, I was asked to do the prize giving at Hazelwood College. I'd never been in Hazelwood. I knew it was there, but I didn't know what to done. And I went along. The principal asked me along to do the prize giving. And I was absolutely blown out of the water. There were kids there from Sandy Row. There were kids there from North Belfast. There were kids there from here and London. And they were all running about, being educated together. And I remember saying to myself when I come away that night, that's got to be part of our future. Mm. Because I've always believed that if you mix young people up from an earlier age and they grow up knowing that, then the life's different. I mean, at the moment, as you know, we have a thing in Northern Ireland looking at paramilitaries. That's too late. Hmm. A guy of 18, 19, 20 years of age, it's too late.
Yeah.
We need to work earlier. So I got involved, as I say, Hazelwood invited me along. And then Bran Small, who's the Northern Ireland fundraiser here, Bran asked me to sit on a little committee raising funds because they decided to raise their own money because they weren't making any headway with the government. And I made it quite clear. I said, well, I've no money. But I, at that time, I didn't realise they were after my name.
Yeah.
And I went on to Brand's little committee. And then it was about a year later, they were being assessed by a big funder. And they came to the conclusion that while it was going along, they needed someone who would be identified as integrated.
Yeah.
And Paul Caskey and Tina Murren asked me, would I do it for a year? And I've never mentioned it since. And I have to say, the more I get into integrated, the more I visit the schools, the more I see the work that's going on. Particularly, you take Malone College. Mm-hmm. Malone College is on the West Belfast Peace Line. There are 17 different languages spoken in Malone.
What?
17. Now, that can't be a bad thing. Mm. Because young people then grow up saying, not everybody talks English or Irish. You know, and the whole spread of... kids at that school, you have kids are, I mean, I know paramilitaries are sending their kids to integrated school because everybody knows this is the way forward.
Yeah.
We're too small here to be separate, you know, and we have a very segregated education. We can't afford the education system we have. And for no other reason, integrated makes economic sense.
Brilliant.
But it's working. We've had a fabulous year this year. And the very fact that Liam Neeson done a little video for us, Integrate My School, it has sold it very well. And, you know, we've had the most amazing successes this year alone. Mm-hmm. We've had three Catholic schools apply to be integrated,
amazing.
Which is a step in the right direction.
That's class.
Because the church has always no-noted.
Sure.
But again, that will happen because pragmatically, you have two schools sitting side by side who are ready to close.
Yeah, it makes
sense. And people say, oh, well, they only come together for their own use. That's okay.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
Okay. I don't care how kids get together, as long as they get together. I'm not one of these people who say, oh, it's got to be this.
Sure.
No. And it's as far as religion in school, and I get into trouble for saying this, I don't believe the Christian religion should be taught in school. I don't believe it should be part of our curriculum. Yes, learn about world religions.
Sure.
But not specifically about Christian religion. I think that should be taught at home.
Yeah.
And I said that to someone fairly high up in the Presbyterian Church. And he said to me, oh, that's nonsense. He says, I wouldn't dream of an integrated school. He says, you're handing over a Protestant school. Anyway, I don't understand that kind of thinking. Mm. I just don't understand it. Because if you go to one of our schools, take Harryville, for instance, up in Ballymena. Now, Harryville had a notorious history. But there's 874 kids go to Harryville.
Unbelievable.
All mixed. And they're about to get a new school.
Crazy.
They're busting at the seams. And I could give you that over and over again.
Yeah.
Where it's working. Cliftonville Primary, it's working. Protestants are coming from the Shankill. North Belfast, which is predominantly Catholic, they're all at school together.
Yeah.
And after all, you go to school to learn about education.
Sure, yeah.
You don't go to learn about religion. And I said to a leading light recently, well, whatever they're teaching in the churches, it isn't working because the churches are all dying on their feet. You know, my own church, for instance, you know, they're all down on their feet. It isn't getting there.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of integrated education is the way we should go, because it teaches young people from a very early age that the guy beside me doesn't have horns.
Mm.
And we're not saying we should love each other. We're not saying they should all be Catholics or Protestants. We're saying be yourself.
Yep.
Be yourself. But don't leave school thinking that the whole world's Protestant or the whole world's Catholic or the whole world speaks Irish or the whole world speaks English. They don't.
Sure.
They don't.
Yeah. How have you know, you've mentioned the peace line a couple of times. You mentioned the wall. How have you managed to win the respect and the working cooperation of both communities? Like, as a simple example, you know, the murals on both sides of the community. Mm-hmm. Not very many people can have a mural on both sides.
True.
How do you think, on reflection, you have been able to achieve that position?
Because if there's a problem on either side of the peace line, and I'm asked to get involved, I don't judge that as a Catholic project or a Protestant. I judge that as a people's project.
Mm.
How can I help these people? And I try to do that to the best of my ability. It doesn't always work out, but the best of my ability, I try to do that. I've worked on both sides because I will not go down the road of saying, no, that's a Catholic communion, I wouldn't help them, and that's a problem. I believe you help people. And my father and mother reared me to believe people were people.
Mm.
As I've already said, I mean, we lived next door to Catholics.
Yeah.
And they came to burn them out. My dad interfered and they burned us out instead.
Wow.
You know, so there's all that experience behind you, but that's not the way to go. The way to go is for people to recognise that there are people in working class areas who are all suffering from the same thing. Protestant Catholics got nothing to do with it. We've all got to make this life as easy as we can for ourselves and our kids.
Mm.
And I think, you know, I try to do that as much as I can.
Yeah. Would you hold the same sort of opinion on the issue of women's rights? Would you say there's no such thing as women's rights, that it's all just human rights? Or what do you think about that?
No, I think, you know, I asked once someone, what's a woman's right any more than a man's right? I don't understand that. I think it's a human right.
Yeah.
And, you know, people long blast me that. I particularly get in trouble with feminists because I'm not a feminist by any means. I believe people are people.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of their gender.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays it's getting to the stage that I don't even understand sometimes what their gender is. But that's another story. That's up to them.
Sure.
But I believe that, you know, people should have the same human rights.
Mm.
And I don't believe that a right should be given any more to a woman specifically because she's a woman, or a man because he's a man. It's all about human rights and it's about moving together on that.
Going to ask you more of a bigger question here. You've had this incredible life, which your opportunities seem to come a lot later than I thought they did. You know, a lot of the big opportunities, like those 32 years in the mills, I can't believe that. I actually honestly can't believe that.
Yeah, well, we see, when I worked in the mill, you were keeping your head down.
Yeah.
Basically, I worked in the mill predominantly in most of the troubles.
Yeah.
I mean, the troubles broke out in 68, 69, and I was already then almost 15 years in the mill. But my intention of a shop steward, and I was a senior steward for a number of years, was to keep the trouble outside the gate.
Mm.
When they come through the gate, Protestant Catholic worked side by side. We were a community. We helped each other. You kept that problem outside the gate.
Yeah.
So I never looked for anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I was asked onto a number of boards and things like that. But certainly coming up to the 90s, when it became known that I was working privately on the some parts of the peace process and that, and trying to do the best for communities. I was invited, for instance, to America to speak at conferences. I didn't even have a passport. And I remember going to America and speaking. And after that, it just snowballed.
Yeah.
After that, just you got one invitation. And even today, I mean, I've been in the States twice this year. You know, it's I don't understand it myself, to be perfectly truthful with you, Matthew.
Wow.
But the way I look at it is I will take every opportunity I can get to promote Northern Ireland.
Amazing.
Every opportunity.
Amazing. So I think the question that's left in my head is, you know, you were talking about Mo Molan's legacy and, you know, what an incredible legacy that is. Baroness May Blood, what an incredible legacy you already have. But what's left? You know, you seem to be very busy in your retirement.
Well, yeah.
You know, what are you focused on now? You know,
well, I'm focused mainly on integrated education. I helped run a big sure start on the Shankill. I'm part of Argyll Business Centre Board in the Shankill, trying to bring in employment. We've just recently bought an old church, which we would like to turn into a hotel and put 120 jobs onto the Peace Line.
Nice.
That will help young people. We're going to try. If we get it up and running, the whole idea would be to teach young people about hospitality.
Yeah.
Because that's where the jobs are going to be in the future.
Yeah.
So it's all about, so I'm busy enough. I mean, people would ask me all over the place to speak at this and speak at that and speak at the other thing. You can't take them all on. You just can't. At my age, I mean, I'm 82 on my next birthday, so you can't do it.
Yeah.
But thankfully, I have a good measure of health and I will do what I can as long as I can.
Yeah.
Have I any more big projects in mind? Yes, I would love to see integrated education become the norm. Instead of all this nonsense about, it's only this, only 7%, it's only 8%, all that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's amazing work going on in Northern Ireland, as I've already said, and we have to keep at it.
Yeah.
We have to keep at it, so we do.
What do you do in your free time? How do you unwind?
Well,
what do you like to do outside of campaigning?
in my free time, I have only one sister left. There were 7 of us originally, so I spend a good lot of time with her.
Nice.
She's 88. And her health's not good, so I spend time with her. I have a brother-in-law in the home. He has dementia, he doesn't know us, but we go and see him. And I have a nephew who's severely mentally handicapped, so I spend time with him. Family comes first. Mm. Family always comes first. And you try to fit everything in around it. It just amazes me why people really want me.
Yeah.
I've never really figured that completely out, when I first went into the House of Lords, as I've already said, everybody seemed to know me. I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah.
And I remember one time being asked to speak at Lancaster University, and they sent a car and all for me, flew me over and sent a car for me. And I tell you, we were going down in the car, and the chauffeur says to me, are there many castles in Belfast? I thought he's coming on holiday. He says, yes, there's one. Belfast Castle's lovely. He says, is that where you live? I says, no. I live in an estate. I didn't tell him the housing executive owned it. When I got to the university, this is what really tickled me. When I got to the university, Dean came down to meet me. And he says to me, Lady Blood, I think I already know you. I Googled you.
Oh.
I didn't know what the man was talking about. And I didn't know where he was being. And funny enough, when I met those folk last Saturday from Holland, that guy said the same thing. He says, I Googled you. You know, it's not my world.
Yeah.
You know, all this internet and all, it's not my world.
Yeah.
And people say to me, just before I left the House of Lords, a peer said to me, May, do you tweet? I said, no, and I don't sit on branches of trees either. Because I don't really understand what they're talking about.
Sure.
But, I mean, if people want me to, if I can help people, I'll do it, as long as I have the health to do it, you know. And that's just the way I am.
Cool.
You know?
We always wrap up the interviews. There's 4 stock questions.
So right.
These are questions we've asked all 90 of our guests. The first one is difficult for a Northern Irish person, and that is, in your own eyes, what has been the most successful moment of your life?
Well, I think in my own eyes, the most successful part of my life would have been certainly in setting up the early years programme on the Shankill.
Mm.
It was badly needed. It was a struggle. You were pushing against the bureaucracy on the Shankill who didn't want it. But I think, you know, when I look back at the number of families that the staff there has helped, 39 full-time jobs.
Wow.
You know, when you look back on that, I think that's got to be one of the highlights.
Brilliant. Flip side of that, and maybe more difficult, is what about the most challenging moment of your life? How were you able to overcome that?
The most challenging part of my life was going into the House of Lords. I was going into an unknown world.
Mm.
I was travelling to England on my own.
Yeah, sure.
I had no support mechanism. I was staying in a hotel on my own. I was going among complete strangers. And I wasn't quite sure if they would get. Sometimes we have a rather crude sense of humour. And I wasn't sure if they would get it. And I have to tell you, the first year, I really thought I'd made a mistake.
Mm.
I actually thought I'd chosen to have the title out of pride.
Interesting.
You know, and it was really a difficult thing. Every morning every week I got up and steeled myself, got on the plane and went over and went in. And, you know, you're wandering around and it was just one of those times. I have to say, if I hadn't had John Laird and Dennis Rogan, I shared an office with them for a while and they went in the same day as me.
Yeah.
If I hadn't had them, I probably would have come home.
Yeah.
It can be a very lonely life. It also can be a very long life because I would have been in my office in Westminster at 8:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And sometimes you wouldn't get out at 10 o'clock at night.
Sure.
So it's a long day.
Wow. Especially for a retired woman.
Especially for a retired woman, yeah.
This is always a favourite of mine. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland out for a cup of tea, let's say dead or alive, anyone across history, who would you take, where would you take them and why?
Well, that's difficult because so many people would come to mind.
Yeah.
You know, who would you take? So many people have helped me in my life that you would like to take them. But I suppose in Northern Ireland, if I was really pushing it, I think I would like to take a Liam Neeson out. And certainly I've had him out. And I would like to take him to the House of Lords. He's such a fascinating character. He's so shy. It's unbelievable. It is absolutely unbelievable.
That's hilarious.
And he's so... such a genuine man, you know. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's funny. One of the reasons why I started the podcast is actually because of Liam Neeson in a very roundabout way.
Right, right.
So I grew up, you know, just like everyone else in Northern Ireland, and I really liked Star Wars as a wee boy.
Yes,
and I was ranting and raving about it one day, and my ma turned around to me in the car one day and she says, "Do you know that he's from Ballymena?" And I could not believe that someone from Northern Ireland had gone on to do such an amazing thing. You know what I mean?
But again, if you're thinking about solely Northern Ireland people, I think Frank Pantridge, Professor Frank Pantridge, who invented the defibrillator and all, he was a man who done all the marvellous work and got no recognition at all. And he has a little saying on his statue at Lisburn, you know, there are three kinds of people. There are people who watch, there are people who wonder, and there are people who do.
Wow.
And Frank Pantridge is one of those. So I suppose it would be interesting to have him.
Oh, that's a great quote. I have to actually look into that. It's great. Yeah. May, final question. And it's same question we finish on all the time. And it's if we could turn this wee recording studio in Omo Bass here into a time machine and go back to, let's say, a 14-year-old version of yourself just before you start working in the mills. And you could grab a hold of her and have a couple of minutes of her time. You know, what would you say to her? What words of advice would you give?
I would say tell her to believe in yourself. When I left school, I hadn't really a great belief. I hadn't really a great confidence in myself. I always thought I'd be bottom of the pile. That's the way I'd been told. And if I could go back in time, I would say to that person, and I say to young people when I met, believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, why would anybody else?
Amazing. May Blood, thank you very, very much.
Pleasure.
For coming on
thank
the show.
You.
Really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
I'm going to do a wee outro here and a wee intro,
that's
if that's okay.
That's
all right. Yeah, I mean, May, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. And for all of you listening, I really, really appreciate you listening all the way through to the end. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I definitely did. It was one of my favorites in here. What a good one for the episode 90th special class. Thank you so much to all of our financial supporters who are part of the Producers Club, who help make this show possible, who help keep us funded. And if you are interested in supporting our journey to 100 episodes and beyond, you can head over again to the website, bestbelfast.org. And my email inbox is open, as always, at matthew@bestofbelfast.org. Thanks very much for listening. My name is Matthew Thompson. This is Best of Belfast. Until next Monday morning, thank you very much and all the very best. Cheers.
Hi everyone, I'm Claire Dowd, GM of Ormo Baths, a tech hub and co-working facility based in the historic Victorian bathhouse in the heart of Belfast city centre. Back in the good old days, Best of Belfast was my commute entertainment. Listening to the inspiring stories of Northern Irish people following their dreams and making magic happen was a great start or end to my day. Now that I've been working from home, I've kept up the same routine and it's a great way for me to continue to brighten my days. My favourite episode, well, it has to be from one of our dear members of our Omo Bass community, Mr. Mark Todd. It was really inspiring and it just made me feel very peaceful, at rest and happy knowing that there's excellent people doing excellent things within Northern Ireland. It is our delight and our pleasure to have Best of Belfast based out of the Ormo Baths. And we're excited about what's coming next. So, if you've been on the fence about joining the Producers Club and would miss Best of Belfast if it wasn't here, I'd highly recommend you joining today. Pop on over to bestofbelfast.org and I look forward to seeing you in our WhatsApp group very soon.